And joining us today on Perspectives is Maria Tatar. And Maria currently teaches in the program in folklore and mythology at Harvard. She is the author of many acclaimed books on folklore and fairy tales, as well as the editor and translator of the annotated Hans Christian Andersen, the annotated Brothers Grimm, the classic fairy tales, a Norton critical edition, and the Grimm Reader. And I don't think you mean Grimm as in the Grim Reaper, right? The Grimm the Brothers.
Grimm the Brothers, and those brothers had the perfect last name for fairy tales. We've forgotten about people like Charles Perrault or Giambattista Basile in Italy, who gave us some of the stories that we tell today. But the Grimms are, well, we even have a TV series,
yes,
a crime series named after them. So they were quite fortunate. Schönbert wasn't quite so lucky, although he does have the word for beautiful embedded in his name, the German word for beautiful, which is schön. And I think that, you know, that's just so fitting, because as ferocious and rough and tumble as some of these stories are, they also have an extraordinary beauty.
And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because we're going to get into the fairy tales, and a lot of people think that, you know, fairy tales are kind of innocent, but they have a story behind the story, and I'm sure you know that, being a scholar and a student of all this, and we'll discuss this. But first, we want to let our readers know as far as what happened with this book. This book is called The Turnip Princess and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales. And so in 2012... something happened in Germany, Maria, if you would fill us in on that.
It happened a few years before 2012, but the final product emerged at that point. Erika Eichenseer, who is an archivist in Bavaria, discovered these dusty boxes, manuscripts of fairy tales that had been collected and written down by Franz Xaver von Schönbert. And these were stories that really were unedited. So they give us a hotline to what people were doing before they were reading books, watching television, using electronic entertainments at night. This is what John Updike called the television and pornography of an earlier age. So there, she had these stories. She selected the best. What we have is just a small sample of the 500 fairy tales she uncovered. But there they are now, translated into English.
Now, as I look at this book, and it's a great book, it's a great, you know, that you can carry it, it's not heavy, it's something that you can put in your backpack or suitcase, whatever you're doing when you travel, because as John Adams once said, you're never alone with a poet in your pocket. And so
perfect. Yeah.
I think that people should carry around books and stuff like that. But you mentioned 500 fairy tales. How did you go about picking the final ones that you put in this book and being able to translate them? And also not just translate them, because sometimes when you translate, the story is lost or the message is lost because you can't really translate literally. And that happens here along the border when you try and translate something from English to Spanish or vice versa. It doesn't come out the same.
There are always challenges. You're exactly right. And Erika did the first initial sorting, and she did leave out many of the tales that were told in dialect, precisely because those would be the most challenging to try to capture. I mean, what are you going to do, tell it in a southern dialect or something like that, which would be weird and I think unsuitable for a variety of reasons. I did make a second cut, and there I would say that I felt I had to trust my instincts. You know a good story when you read it. It just pops. And so I wish I could have included everything in this wonderfully portable edition, as you describe. I love the fact that you talked about how this is easy to travel with. And I think fairy tale characters also travel lightly. There's a wonderful, and you know, they don't carry much psychological baggage with them. We have to sort of fill in what they're thinking. We have to try to figure out what's on their minds.
We are visiting with Maria Tatar, and she is the editor of The Turnip Princess and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales.
Oh, right. So I was saying that Erica made the first cut of the tales, and she left out many that were in dialect, precisely because they would be the most challenging to translate into an English idiom. And I then made a second cut. She sent me, I think, about 100. And there I really followed my instincts. And, you know, I firmly believe you, when you see a great story, you know it, you recognize it, and things go off in your head. And so those were the stories that I included in the anthology.
Now, as you mentioned, because of the dialect, one looks at fairy tales, folk tales, and, you know, there are different kinds of stories. So how would you describe the difference between, say, what people call fairy tales and folk tales?
Folk tales are definitely more realistic. They're set in the here and now. They're plausible. They often take the form of jokes or anecdotes or gossip in a way. And fairy tales, I would say the real difference is that they contain magic. And no one is ever surprised or startled or shocked when a wolf starts talking or when there's a witch in the woods whose house is made of bread and candy and her windows are of spun sugar and all of that. So the fairy tales, because they contain this magic, have a high coefficient of weirdness. They're just strange things. You read them and they become like, what was it that Churchill said about Russia, that it's a mystery wrapped in an enigma contained in a riddle or something like that. You have to start thinking immediately. All your brain gets rewired, and first fried and then rewired as you start trying to figure out, why is this happening? How is the hero or the heroine going to get out of this one? What sort of monster is this, and how are you going to get rid of it? What will you do in this situation? So you're constantly, the characters in fairy tales are constantly bombarded with these terrible things happening to, you know, these what ifs, these counter, in most cases, counterfactual factuals, not things that happen to us in real life, and therefore all the more perplexing.
We are visiting with Maria Tatar. She is the editor of The Turnip Princess and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales. And this is a very interesting book that contains more than 70 stories, and they bring us closer to some of the oral tradition in which fairy tales are rooted. And one of the things that you mentioned, fairy tales have certain characters, and so when we think of fairy tales, a lot of us always usually think of a dragon, a princess, a tailor, an evil stepmom. So when you went telling me about this is something that people did back then instead of their electronic devices and anything like that, so they would sit around and read some of these stories, or what did you mean by that?
Well, they would tell the stories. And it's, think of those long evenings. There's maybe in the winter, there's a fire at the hearth. What are people doing? They're spinning yarn and flax. They're repairing tools. They're taking care of household chores. It's boring. And to the rhythms of these repetitive labors comes song and story, both of which lighten the labors and make times pass quickly. So imagine, you know, you need a great story to get people's attention. So what are you going to do? You're going to do exactly what we do today, put in lots of sex and violence into our entertainments. Look at what we watch on television, House of Cards, Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul. All of those, you know, these are melodramatic stories packed with action, not a lot of analysis of characters, but and, you know, the great thing about the stories, too, is I think that the gifted narrators, and there certainly were many of them, as we know from accounts, autobiographical, biographical accounts, they knew how to let us see what was going on. They had vivid descriptive powers. So you can just follow these tales, and they're so animated. They're wonderfully, I mean, it's no accident, I think, that they became animated cartoons because they are precisely so lively. And so these were stories that also were multi-generational. That is, not just for the kids, as they often are seen today. I think that's changing quite a bit, but they were stories that appealed to all ages, and that then were gradually, over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, moved into the nursery.
So what about, as you and I, you know, grew up listening to certain fairy tales, as you mentioned, the cartoons, Walt Disney, Cinderella, Mother Goose, anything like that. At what point did the media start changing these fairy tales and making them a little bit darker to show that other side that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the remarkable things about the fairy tale, and I mentioned magic as a distinguishing feature, is also its power to morph into something else. That is, these stories never sit still or stand still or any. They're always changing. So there was a certain point in the 19th century when, as I say, they moved from the childhood of culture into the culture of childhood. And suddenly there were all these morals and messages. They took on a sort of disciplinary edge. And so they were for the children. And why? They were meant as what the Grimms called their collection a behavioral manual. They were supposed to send messages, teach lessons, and all of that. And I think what has happened in the last 20 years or so, and maybe I would date it back to Angela Carter's rewritings of fairy tales for adults, and Sexton's remarkable book of poems called Transformations, which takes the Grimm's tales, rewrites them for adults, and then Hollywood, which, you know, starting with Pretty Woman, I think, kept giving us one Cinderella story after another, until finally, you know, today what is remarkable to me is we acknowledge the cultural heritage of fairy tales. We acknowledge them as belonging to everybody. We call the film Cinderella, and it's live action now. We call it Red Riding Hood or Sleeping Beauty. And so they've really come to the forefront of our consciousness. What is remarkable about Schoendat's collection, I think, which kind of rejiggers things for us, is that we discover that there are all kinds of male characters that we have neglected. In The Flying Trunk, there's a boy who has a pair of red boots, which he absolutely adores and wears everywhere. And then when he goes on a trip and meets a princess, he loses one of the shoes. And the girl's father has to track down the owner of this boot. In the Turnip Princess, the first story, there's a young man who falls asleep on his horse on the side of the road, and he wakes up. We don't know how long he slept, but when he wakes up, he's got a long beard. So it must be quite a while. So you have a, that may not be a male Sleeping Beauty story, but there are several stories in this collection in which boys or young men fall asleep and are also described as quite beautiful while they are sleeping.
We're visiting with Maria Tatar. She is the editor of the book called The Turnip Princess and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales. And these are fairy tales by von Schoenwerth. And am I correct in saying that you translated them or you edited them?
That's right.
Okay. Now, as far as selecting the stories, as you mentioned earlier, there are more than 500. You have about 70 or a little more here in this book. Why The Turnip Princess? Why did you decide to put that on the cover, on the title?
Well, for one thing, I love the title, the Turnip Princess. And actually, it was my editor who proposed that as a I had originally thought of The Enchanted Quill, which is comes early on in the collection, too, about a young woman who makes her wishes come true by writing them down, which is really quite extraordinary, the idea of the heroine as writer. But the Tuna Princess I love because the very name encapsulates how fairy tales combine the ordinary with the extraordinary. Sometimes the grotesque and the bizarre with the beautiful. That is, we get a kind of interesting aesthetics. It's not classical, good, true, and beautiful. But sometimes things that are ugly and strange that become ennobled through words, through the story that is told about them. The Tuna Princess itself is wild and zany. That is, there's so many plot. It's only two or three pages, but there's so much going on that I still have to go back and reread it and try to puzzle out what is happening. And I think that, there was a point at which I had to make a decision. Was I going to translate the stories, capture the spirit of what Schoenvatt had listened to, what he had heard from the voices of the storytellers, or was I going to prettify them, make them a little easier to read and more homogenous? Was I going to use the style that the Grimms developed over the course of the seven editions that their collection went through? They sort of, the tales became more and more literary in a sense. And I decided that we had plenty of stories like that, that what we needed was a dose of reality. You know, this is what the stories were like when they were told. They had rough edges. There were lots of bumps in the road. And I love that about these stories because, again, you know, they make you think. They make you create your own story or stories, multiple stories in your head, and try to figure out what's going on, and they then give the group that was listening to them something to talk about, something to puzzle out collectively.
One of the things that the book mentions here, it's written in the back, it says that with this volume, it says that this is the Holy Trinity of fairy tales, the Brothers Grimm, Charles Perrault, and Hans Christian Andersen, but now with Schoenvatt is a quartet. Can you tell us a little bit about the quartet and explain a little bit about how each of these writers differ or are similar as far as fairy tales?
Oh, that's a great question because you can take it back to Charles Perrault, a Frenchman who in 1697 gave us our first print version of Little Red Riding Hood. And that is the story that's still told in France today, but it's not the story that we know, because in the version, the French version, the girl is devoured by the wolf, and she never makes it out of the belly of the wolf. And so there's Perrault writing these stories down just about, actually, he disavowed the notion of Charles Perrault as author. He distanced himself from it. He claimed that his nephew, Pierre d'Armancourt, had written down the stories, which is preposterous because the nephew was 12 years old at the time. But Perrault gave us Sleeping Beauty, Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, the Cinderella that we can see today on screen in the live-action Disney version, and also a number of tales which are not as well known. Then along come the Brothers Grimm more than a century later, at the beginning of the 19th century, and they're at an important inflection point as well. But even more than Perrault, they tried to make these stories for children. And so they went through this process over a period of decades of rewriting the stories, making them more child-friendly, and as importantly, more parent-friendly as well. And so they're straddling, these are stories that straddle the line between adult entertainments and literature for, and really literature, because they're trying to get all the vulgar elements out of it for children. And then we have the interesting phenomenon of Hans Christian Andersen, who listened to fairy tales as a child in spinning rooms. And what did he do? For a while, he thought he might write some of those stories down from memory, but then he changed his mind, and he created his own fairy tales, The Little Match Girl, The Little Mermaid, all of these terrible tales in which children or young women perish, The Red Shoes. She lives, but only after her feet are chopped off by an executioner. So these were seen, you know, I use the term child-friendly. Andersen thought, you know, the stories were for children, again, to teach them lessons. But these are, The Red Shoes is something that we would not want to tell children today, nor are we interested in The Little Mermaid's conversion to Christianity, which is how, and her death in Andersen's story. So we have all of these different types of tales, tellers and writers. And then along comes Schoenwert, and Schoenwert gives us something completely different, I think. He moves us away from the literary back to the oral storytelling tradition. So we get a window into what the stories were like a long time ago and far away.
You mentioned, Maria, about some of those stories that were not so nice about, because the children perish and the children, you know, the little girl loses her feet. So tell me, as a professor of mythology and folklore and fairy tales, how has all that changed? Because today, in order to be politically correct, some of those fairy tales have changed. And, you know, you don't want to make wolves feel bad. You don't want to make pigs feel bad. So everything has changed. Tell us how that affects fairy tales or even, you know, your courses.
Well, I think that I mentioned that fairy tales are always changing, morphing, turning into new versions of themselves. And I think today we value empathy and we value difference. And the monster, we sort of come to recognize that we are often the monster. And when you have, for example, in Little Red Riding Hood, the predator-prey relationship, the wolf versus the so-called innocent girl, you begin to realize, you know, maybe that today, at least, the wolf is the victim. And now, you know, not everyone would say that, but that certainly nature is the victim of human predatory behavior. We have done a lot to despoil the environment. So you have suddenly films in like Wolf, in which Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer go back into the woods. That's the happy ending. They turn into wolves. Angela Carter, who has the Beauty and the Beast transformation, be a return to nature. Both the young man and the young woman turn into tigers and live happily ever after. So there has been this extraordinary shift in the way that we see things. And also, I think of the Disney Cinderella film, where again and again you hear Cinderella saying this and the fairy godmother telling her this, you know, you must be kind and courageous. Kind and courageous, not curious, cunning, as many fairy tale heroes or heroines are, but those are the cultural values that are enshrined, embedded in that story.
And we are visiting with Maria Tatar. She is the editor of The Turnip Princess and other newly discovered fairy tales. And one of the things that people might wonder also, Maria, is what is the difference or what is the connection between fairy tales and nursery rhymes?
Well, the fairy tales moved, as I said, they moved into the nursery. They became child-friendly. Nursery rhymes, too, are forms of entertainment for children. But in both of these genres, these two forms of entertainment, we find that there often is a slightly sadistic element. That is, there's a lot of scary stuff in these rhymes and stories. Remember the old woman who lived in the shoe? I can't recite it for you, but I remember being horrified by the fact that she whipped all her children and put them to bed. Then there's the ring around a Rosie, which evidently has some allusions to the plague. Ashes, ashes, we all fall down. So there's, you know, we think of these nursery rhymes as gentle and innocent, but they're not at all. And again, with fairy tales, even when they're edited and censored and there's an effort to take out the scary stuff, there's still something at the core of these stories that is deeply disturbing. And these are vehicles for confronting the young and the old with the hard facts of life, the scary things that are out there. You know, sometimes I wonder, should we really be sanitizing these stories? Yes and no, because sometimes I think what is important is to observe the child listener, and if the scary stuff is too much for the child, then stop, change it around, make it kind and gentle, and turn it into a lesson about kindness and courage, as Disney does with Cinderella.
We're talking about the book, The Turn of Princes and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales, and Maria Tatar has been our guest. Now, Maria, if people want to find out more about what you've been discussing, and we've haven't just barely touched upon what, you know, there's so much history that you can tell us about fairy tales, the Grimm brothers, Hans Christian Andersen. This book has just a 70 or a little bit more. Are there other books coming out, or is there a web page that they can go to find out more about fairy tales and history?
Well, there is the German website for Schönwert, but for readers who have not mastered German and may not want to dig deeply just into Schönwert, there's a wonderful site called Sur la Lune, S-U-R-L-A-L-U-N-E, which is the web mistress or webmaster is Heidi Ann Heiner, and it contains all kinds of stories and illustrations. It's a site that I go to all the time, and it's very well curated and kept up to date.
Okay, Maria, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. We've been visiting with Maria Tatar. She is the editor and translator of the book called The Turnip Princess and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales, and you'll be able to read some great fairy tales. And as I mentioned, this is a very portable book, short stories, so you can read these in between tasks or whatever you're doing on the plane, walking, whatever. Thank you very much for being with us, Maria.
Great to talk. Thanks for inviting me.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Belinda Alvarez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.